This is Doug Cooper for Iona College Conversations, brought to you by Iona College in New Rochelle, New York. And today it's my great privilege and honor to be speaking with one of America's great musicians. There are very few professions in which there is one man in the field who so far surpasses all the others that he is the clear number one figure. But in the roll call of the great organists of the world, there is just such a man, and he is my guest for the broadcast today, Mr. E. Power Biggs. It's a great pleasure to be with you here at your home in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Thank you. It's extremely nice of you to come here.
Well, Mr. Biggs, I understand that in some years you've traveled as much as 75 or 80,000 miles to play the organs which are your favorites around the world.
I suppose it may add up to a large figure. It sometimes seems like that anyway. Of course, before playing and recording any of these organs, you have to go and look at them. So that means an exploratory trip. And then you have ideas about a certain organ you think is wonderful, and then you have ideas about the music that seems to go best on it. And then you have to come back and arrange things with the recording company, and then go back again and do the actual recording.
This is an interesting point about this instrument, that each one is different, and you have to have days of preparation on the individual instrument to become accustomed to it, don't you?
Yes. I'd say no two organs are alike, speaking generally. No two large organs are alike anyway. But you know, that gives the organ, which is such an old instrument going back through the centuries, a unique interest. Organs are national in their character. English organs are totally unlike Spanish organs. And Dutch and German organs are totally unlike, let's say, Italian organs. But then, of course, there's a very close connection between organs and the national organ music. The Spanish organ music fits the Spanish organs. It was written for them, really. Or you might say the Spanish organs, their character, their wonderful reeds, the wonderful trumpet stops and so on, this character almost formed the Spanish music.
That seems to be a unique country, though, in that respect, because you said Bach would have had a tough time in Spain.
You can't play Bach on Spanish organs because most of the time they don't have any pedals. On the other hand, if you play Spanish music, which demands trumpets, on the German organs that are so perfect for Bach, the Spanish music doesn't sound very well. In other words, the national character of organs and music go together, and that gives the whole organ repertoire a wonderful variety. All these different nations wrote differently because they had different instruments.
Well, Mr. E. Power Biggs, you were the man who used that line, the famous phrase, "You can't take it with you," in regard to this instrument, the organ. And that's a very important thing to think about, because when you're going to play somewhere, you're going to have to use the instrument that's in that locality and not the one of your choice.
Yes, well, of course, "you can't take it with you" implies that that's a sort of Jack Benny type of joke from one point of view. You can't take it with you, but then you probably have to play the harp anyway later on.
Well, if you've got your personal ship, I guess you could take it along.
But what I was really talking about was this. The violinist takes it with him. The flutist just puts it in his pocket. And even the pianist can take his instrument in the baggage car, as Paderewski did, but the organist can't take it with him. So as an organist, you play, you go to your instrument and you play what you find. And that's very interesting. It's an awful nuisance in many cases, because when you go to play a concert, sometimes you find you don't like the organ too much, but you have to play it anyway. But that's fun. That's part of the fun of concerts. On the other hand, for recordings, you want to be very sure of your ground, because I feel that every record one makes should have a point to it. The organ music of France on French organs. The organ music of Holland on Dutch organs. Of England on English organs. Or, if you like, the two Rheinberger, Joseph Rheinberger concertos for organ and orchestra, never recorded before on LP anyway. And every record I make, even the ragtime pieces of Scott Joplin, I try to give every record a certain reason for existence, a certain point to it. The approach is very different to giving a concert.
Well, Mr. Biggs, let me ask for a certain amount of immodesty on your part now. Would you tell us how many albums you've recorded?
Well, I think I've done about 60 or 70 LP albums for Columbia. And if you count the monophonic records I've made in the 78s, I suppose it's pretty nearly 100 albums altogether.
The 78s go back to what year?
Well, 78s go back to about 1950... About 1949, just before 1950. I've been with Columbia Records just over 25 years.
I think, Mr. Biggs, this requires me to bring in a little bit of your own personal history. You became a U.S. citizen in 38, was it?
Yes, 37 or 38. Yes, 37, actually, I think.
It wasn't long thereafter that you started that great series on CBS around 1942.
It was in 1942, yes. And just before that, I had made some recordings for Victor. But just soon after 1942, I fortunately went to Columbia.
Now, these two elements, I'm sure, the albums and the radio, much more, I'm sure you would agree, than your concerts in these areas, is what really brought up the popularity of this instrument.
Yes, I think it was that, because the broadcasts from the Germanic Museum of Harvard University, which used to take place every Sunday morning at 9:30, went right over the CBS network, coast to coast, and they went on out to the Yukon and Alaska.
I understand you've had mail from Australia.
Me. Yes. But one of the faithful listeners was a chap called Hugh Blair in the Yukon. He was responsible for the long telephone lines in the far north over a great area, and he used to listen, and it would be, let me see, nine, it would be about four in the morning for him, and he would write and say, I enjoyed this broadcast, that broadcast, and your guest, artist Roger Voisin, the trumpeter, played magnificently and so on. It was quite eerie to have these letters coming, you know. And then he said, I live out here in the middle of nowhere. I live all by myself, except for my cat, so-and-so. better company than many humans, he wrote. But then letters came even from Europe, middle of Europe, in Berlin, all over Europe, where it was rebroadcast by American Armed Forces Network Radio. You're right, radio had a terrific coverage in those days.
Well, was it this that caused the resurgence in composition for the organ, the composers who heard this on the radio and heard it through your albums?
Well, I don't know if there's been any great resurgence, but I was privileged to play the first performance of a concerto by Walter Piston, Leo Salvi, Roy Harris, various people who were kind enough to write pieces that we played for solo organ or for organ and a small orchestra on those programs.
Well, it makes me wonder now, do you accept the characterization that people have used about you, that you are a revivalist?
Well,
we're talking about the question of the amount of resurgence of new composition.
Yes.
And you don't feel there's been too much.
I don't feel there's
been. Although what there has been for you.
Oh, no, not at all. But some of those pieces were written for our broadcasts, and it was a privilege to have them. That was a very creative period in radio broadcasting, you know. James Fassett of CBS ran the Sunday afternoon Philharmonic programs, the School of the Air, the CBS String Quartet, and various other programs, and everything was live and created on the spot. Nothing was just played from a record, and there was a lot of new music written and played at that time. Radio was a very creative thing. I don't think television is for music. Maybe for other things. Now, another person who has played a great part in my life and in this renewed interest, if you like, increased interest in organ music, besides James Fassett, who, in a sense, put me on the network, is Goddard Lieberson, who is the president of Columbia Records. Now, you asked when I began with Columbia Records, and I said 50, more or less. That is 25 years ago. Well, it was Goddard Lieberson at a time, this was before LP, you know, when the organ didn't sound too well on 78s. It was rather scratchy, and it rather tended to burst the medium, if you know what I mean, to distort.
Yes.
But Goddard Lieberson said, oh, let's try, you know. And one record led to another, LP came in, and so here we are 25 years later. With about 70 records available, all the way from Bach to, well, back to Perrotin and Leoninus, up through Bach, through Rheinberger, and up to modern concertos of Copland and so on, with the New York Philharmonic, you know.
Let me remind listeners that this is Doug Cooper. I'm in the lovely Cambridge, Massachusetts home of Mr. E. Power Biggs. And Mr. Biggs, by the way, Power Biggs, that was originally a hyphenated name, wasn't it?
Yes, but that's a frightful nuisance, so I never use it. But that's the legal name, yes.
It's a very fascinating name now. It's a very, very powerful name.
Well, perhaps.
Mr. Biggs, I wanted to get back to the organ itself. We were talking before we went on the air a little bit about the attachment of the organist to his instrument. The fact that it goes beyond really playing that instrument, it goes to the milieu in which it's played, it goes to the makeup of the instrument itself, doesn't it?
Yes. I suppose every organist is an individual, and every instrument is an individual. And you're very fortunate if your professional duties allow you to play a good instrument. The fascinating thing about recording the organ is that there is a history in Europe. There is this fabric of history of organ construction going right back to 1390. There is an organ in Sion, which is spelled S-I-O-N, in Switzerland, which was built in 1390. And you can still play it today, and you can pull the stops that were played in 1390, and you can literally, like an H.G. Wells time machine, go back through the years and hear the sounds that they heard. Now, you don't play Bach on such an instrument. You play Perrotin, Leoninus, early plain song, and so on. But you think of that. You can't do that for the piano. Well, the piano didn't exist. The harpsichord didn't exist. The orchestra didn't exist. Practically none of the music we know today existed in 1390. And yet there is this organ, which will play for you, if you play it, in the exact terms that it played for those people in those days. Think of that, 50 years before Gutenberg and the invention of movable type, 100 years before Columbus sailed over here. Well, there's that organ. Then you can play organs of 1550 that Bach played during his lifetime. You can play organs of Mozart, organs that Mozart played. He played many organs in Austria and in Holland.
And the Haydn and the Handel organs.
Exactly. There are organs in England that Handel played, so you can handle the Handel
organ. You can handle the Handel.
That's right.
Handel was really the gentleman of the musicians, wasn't he? He was a great fellow and also a philanthropist.
Exactly. He was the greatest character among musicians, in my opinion. Bach, of course, is you can't sum up Bach. I mean, it's impossible. But Handel was a human being. He was a great man. He was an impresario. He was a humorist. He was a great composer. He was a great player. He was a great businessman. He failed in business, you know, but he'd come right back. He led a magnificent life. I made two records, you know, which I call Handel the Magnificent. The Magnificent Mr. Handel, excuse me. And I love that music. It's the breath of fresh air, you know. Well, anyway, he had a great career in England. He never played in church, except for special occasions. But he used to play in the theatres, a small organ. He'd play his concertos with orchestra. And then, of course, he did write The Messiah, and he gave all the proceeds to the Foundling Hospital, you know, the hospital for, well, the Children's Hospital of London. He was a great philanthropist, you're right. He was a great character.
Well, I know that one way to make myself feel terribly inadequate is to think about Bach, who, about my age, 24 and 25, was the court musician, and he was a great organist at that young state.
Yes, he was.
And a good friend of Walther, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Walther, yes, Johann Gottfried Walther. Yes, indeed. Of course, Bach lived a totally different life. Handel never married. Bach had how many children? 20, 18, 20, I forget. But think, he had to have somebody pump the organ, you see, for his practice. So that's why he had so many children, don't you think?
I wanted to remind you and our listeners, in speaking about Bach, before I forget about this, that you were invited to East Germany to play that Bach instrument. Didn't the government bring you over?
Yes, indeed. Just about 3 years ago, and the record, the Columbia record, resulted Bach in the Thomaskirche. Bach in the Thomas Church. Yes, it was. I regard that as the greatest privilege of my life, to be invited over there by these Germans, the East Germans, to play in Bach's church, to record Bach's music, the D minor, the Pasquale, you know. It was an experience that Peggy and I, my wife, will never forget. We were there all week, recording all night, because all day the church is open, you see. And people flock through that church all day long, from all over the world, really. It's very impressive. Well, we recorded night after night, all week long, and we finally got what we wanted, I think. The ending experience stays with me particularly because we came out into this misty courtyard and there was this great Bach statue looming up, you know, it was about 4 a.m. And there was the other building where Bach would walk to from the church every day between the choir school and the church. And you really felt he's still here. He isn't far away at all. Of course, he died in, 1750. 1685 to 1750.
I've heard other organists say that the same thing. Is it the environment that's maintained? If it were in a stark, cold building, would you still have that feeling of kinship?
Yes. We were there in June. The weather was quite acceptable. But you just feel this is it. And then a contributing factor is this, that the East Germans haven't done anything to it. Of course, they keep it up perfectly, and they're proud of it. I mean, the East Germans are above all Bach lovers. That's where it all happened. But there are no peanut stands, so to speak. I don't know whether you've ever been to St. Mark's in Venice, the great cathedral. Well, all around the square, there are these vendors of this, that, and the other, and, you know, it's...
would be artists...
It's a bazaar, it's a sort of, whatever you like to call it. But Bach, no, Bach has just left. Here Bach was. The wonderful thing is, there is a small sign, or only about, 18 inches long and a foot high perhaps. All it says is, here, John Sebastian Bach lived and worked. And then it gives his dates. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, they take it for granted. You know all about Bach.
Oh, yes.
And everyone does.
Mr. Biggs, the tone of these instruments really has been maintained. How has it been maintained?
In the case of Bach's own church, the instruments don't connect with Bach. The organ in the gallery was built around 1880, and that has very little to do with Bach's music, because it was built in the wrong period. It was built, it's a sort of romantic organ, the organ in the gallery. Now, the East Germans were dissatisfied with that as representing Bach's organ works. If somebody played the Paschalian Fugue, they didn't like it on that organ. So they built another organ at the other end of the church, the front end of the church, a tracker action organ by Schuker of Dresden. And that's the organ I played, a relatively new organ, about 5 years old, which is in the Bach style.
Yes. Well, we'll have to talk more about Bach on next week's program, because unfortunately we are out of time for today, Mr. Biggs. I've been speaking with E. Power Biggs on Iona College Conversations. My name is Doug Cooper, and I want to be sure to invite you to join us for next week's program, when I'll continue this very enlightening and delightful discussion at the home of Mr. E. Power Biggs in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Incidentally, the excerpts from the recordings you heard today are authentic. They were made by Mr. Biggs on great organs in many countries around the world. Mr. Biggs, it's been just a delight and very, very informative speaking with you today. Thank you so much for letting me come and visit with you.
Thank you indeed for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you.